Welcome to History Lessons, an Engelsberg Ideas podcast featuring the world's leading historians answering the big questions, hosted by Matthias Hesseris.
Hello. The UK's government communications headquarters, GCHQ, has inspired much academic research, many films, and quite a few more puzzle books. But access to the organisation's own archives and the opportunity to talk to personnel on the inside has been notoriously limited. This is until 2018, when Professor John Ferris at Calgary University, Alberta, was asked by the British government to write an official history of GCHQ. Having signed the Official Secrets Act, Ferris was given unprecedented access to GCHQ personnel and internal archives, some dating back to the 19th century. And now, his 1,000-page chronicle of the origins and development of British signals intelligence, Behind the Enigma, the authorized history of GCHQ, is available for all to read. We are pleased to have John with us on this episode of History Lessons to discuss. John, thank you for joining.
Glad to be here.
But before we start talking about your book, this is we're recording this on a day where it's just been a pretty amazing and incredible hacking scandal in the US. Could you say something about that?
This is part of the new normal. It's not going to go away. At the moment, we're not certain how thorough the penetration was, but it seemingly is clearly a very sophisticated attack. When I say that it's the new normal, I mean this has been going on now for over 20 years, but this penetration certainly ranks among the greatest I know of. The dilemma really is that we do not know how far Russian hackers, and it's associated with a group called Crazy Bear, actually penetrated the system. We don't know how many left behind networks they have. So at the moment, it's all speculation. Let me simply say that everyone living in any industrialized country has to assume that this is part of your daily life. And the Russians, the PRC, criminals, and for those of you who are neutrals, also people from my side, are going to be potentially penetrating your civilian government networks, commercial networks, et cetera, et cetera. And it's potentially very alarming in the sense that I would say that from what we've heard so far, the Russians clearly could have affected a great deal of damage on American security and business firms. But on the other hand, so far in these kind of cyber things, people have avoided real destruction. In other words, they've used it to extract intelligence. They have not used their access to those nets in order to damage the functioning of those companies or businesses or government agencies. Nonetheless, this is going to go on in our lifetime. It is not going to stop.
And it sort of leads us back because actually we're now in a moment when this is obviously and as we've seen today quite severe, but if we look at a history of information gathering, then by other means, and it wasn't then, of course, digital. It all goes back to at least the 19th century. When you started to take on GCHQ and to write the official history, let's just start with the sheer size of the task that was set before you here. Because you suggest in your introduction that the research was a challenge not only due to the scale of material available, but also the fact that much of it is still classified. So how did you manage to craft a narrative out of this material?
Well, first of all, I've been working on GCHQ records as an historian since the early 1980s. I was working in records where theoretically they had cleansed or weeded every reference to SICKEN, but I managed to find them. And through the years, as they began to release more material, I continued to follow up. So that meant that I already had the experience of knowing how they worked. But for the post-1945 material, the dilemma was I was given access to a huge amount of material on topics which were not well known. In many cases, I was the first person to go through the material. I had to make sense of what was going on. I had to learn the inner workings of what had been a secret organization. And very basic administrative things like how many people worked for them, who were they, how much did they get paid, were issues I had to deal with, as well as the very complicated technical and political issues. So it was like learning rapidly how one of the most important agencies in Britain operated, and doing it really from the basis of no secondary sources that could help me. So on the one hand, it was very frightening. On the other hand, it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, but also, how do you go about it as an historian? Because you also handle things that, in a sense, we have to keep secrets and as states and allies and so when you go about this, you might understand things that maybe shouldn't be out in the public. What is your view on that?
Well, first of all, as far as I'm concerned, the agencies are entirely right to keep hidden their current technical capabilities. And if you happen to have a zero exploit weakness in a commercial firm of your own country, in fact, you might be well advised to keep it a secret yourself. Mm. Although you might also find that it's better to warn the company. It really varies from case to case. But you have to conceive of this as being a constant competition with hostile powers who are trying to damage you. Mm. And if you're not capable, then you can't protect yourself from the kind of attack the Americans have just experienced. And it's not just the Americans, because what the Russians did in this case actually was to penetrate into major commercial providers, which means that firms in Sweden and Canada and many other places might well find that some of their materials compromised.
Before we get into the history, what does GCHQ do precisely? And what is its relationship to the other intelligence organizations like MI6, for example?
Okay, GCHQ collects primarily these days cyber intelligence, but historically what it did was focus on government-to-government communications by radio or cable. Nowadays, given the nature of the internet, if you're going to collect SIGINT, you have to do bulk collection. You're vacuuming up literally billions of telecommunications events a day. You can only hold them for a few days before you have to flush them. And then you're looking for connections between IP addresses, i.e. who is talking to who. Mm. If you become interested in communications, you might then say, all right, these are two foreigners who we have reason to believe are conducting espionage or terrorism. Let us attack their communications, try to strip the encryption and read them. Hmm. You're also going after foreign hostile government communications, but also neutrals.
Yeah.
And in the world of SIGINT, neutrals are fair game.
And why is that?
Because neutrals interact with your government. Hmm. They compete with you on all sorts of different issues. So if you were to look, for example, at one of the number one British foreign policy concerns today, which is the 18th of December, 2020, it's negotiations with the European Union, who are friends, mm-hmm. and in some cases neutrals. I should be surprised to find the British are not trying to collect SIGINT on that. Mm. And they're quite right to do so. And I guarantee the Germans and the French are trying to do the same thing back.
Yeah. And GCHQ has existed since the 1940s. But your history goes right back into the early 19th century. So why did you choose to start there? And how does the story actually begin?
Well, the story really begins in the 1890s when the British government decides that it should exploit its high level of control over international telegraph cables in wartime only to harm an enemy and to collect material on it. And so the British from the 1890s are thinking about some elements of what becomes SIGINT. But nobody in the world really links everything together until the First World War breaks out. Mm-hmm. So in the last week of July 1914, virtually nobody's conducting SIGINT. 2 weeks later, most major states are starting to do so. You're intercepting hostile communications by radio, which you can pick up. If they're encrypted, the codes are actually sufficiently primitive that amateurs can start to break them, And suddenly you can provide live intelligence to armies in the field. Hmm. So for the British Expeditionary Force in the first 2 months of the war, they intercept well over 200 radio messages between German corps and German army groups.
Yeah.
Which really gives you a very clear picture of what the enemy is trying to do to you. And from that moment on, it's hard to stop because states realize there's so much valuable material to be acquired.
Yeah. And then if we jump to the bit in World War II, because at this point, it is the Government Code and Cipher School, as it's called, which would be renamed later to GCHQ in 1949, it first enters sort of the public imagination with Bletchley Park. And the story of Enigma has been covered many times, but one area you challenge is the perception that this was just a story of great men like Alan Turing. What do you think is wrong with this narrative?
Well, the two things I would say, first of all, are that although Turing is a genius, and in fact he's the single most important figure involved in this process, on his own, that's not enough to make it work. I would say there are in the neighborhood of 50 to 100 people, all of whom are necessary to the way the British developed SIGINT fundamentally in the Second World War.
Yeah.
Take away any one of them and you would have major problems. The second thing I'd say is the British, for complicated reasons, overestimate the significance of ULTRA to British and Allied victory in the war. I'm willing to say that I've never seen an organization like Bletchley. And certainly ULTRA is first rate as an intelligence source. Mm. But in the end, SIGINT never can win a victory on its own. It's only by reinforcing powerful, well-led military forces, which the British and the Western Allies had. Mm. So what I say in the end is I'm stunned by how good Bletchley was and very impressed by individuals like Turing. And there's nothing like it anywhere in the world, anywhere else. And second, it really matters, but it doesn't win the war.
No. But it's interesting that you point out the collaboration side of this, and it seems to be integral to SIGINT in a sense, because GCHQ seems also to be part of a wider story about the collaboration of British institutions. So where does British industry, especially technology and telecoms, fit into this? And what explains their sort of long-term success in developing a world-leading intelligence organization?
Well, first of all, in every country, and it's not just China, there are links between national telecommunications organizations and states. That's just the way it is. Mm-hmm. We don't trust the Chinese quite reasonably, and therefore we look at their current offerings, Huawei, with genuine and real concern. But, you know, it's not as though we are virgins in this field. The real point is that the British from the beginning end up creating high-grade cryptanalytical and SIGINT organizations. And I think it's partly because there is in Britain an unusual and particular link between academic agencies and the government. And the British state has been willing and able quite frequently to bring in leading edge techniques, especially in communications, to aid its power.
Yeah.
And there's a political science theory called path dependency.
Yes.
That says that organizations can take very different forms when they're emerging, but once they emerge, they're really walking down a road that's hard to get off. And in some ways, what I would say is that the British, to some degree by fluke, end up walking down a very productive road in signals intelligence, and as a result, do well. But there are lots of countries which do well too. It's not as though the British are the only one.
No. And so GCHQ sort of helps Britain it gives Britain leverage, I suppose. And how important was GCHQ in maintaining Britain's position in the post-war period?
There are a number of different points there. One of them is that the British decline from being a world power to, by the end of the Cold War, being one of the most important secondary powers. But they're important enough that having a first-rate SIGINT agency really matters to your national capabilities. a lot of what happened, I didn't see material on. So diplomatic communications, intelligence, I saw nothing on after the Second World War, but I imagine that there are successes there. But if you look at instances like the Falklands conflict, it's crystal clear that British success in SIGINT is fundamental to British victory in what proves to be a more important conflict than one would have thought. Beyond that, SIGINT is one of the areas where the British remain alliance-worthy, maintain a lot of influence in NATO and over the Americans, and SIGINT actually helps to keep the British at their upper secondary status as a power all the way through the Cold War. So it's, if you look at how inexpensive SIGINT was in this period, it's an extremely good investment.
And also it becomes central to, I suppose, Five Eyes. First of all, can you tell us what Five Eyes is?
Okay. The term Five Eyes simply refers to the fact that there's an intelligence product shared by the Anglophone countries, which means that the materials can be seen by American, British, Australian, Canadian, and New Zealand people. So it's Five Eyes. Whereas if it's for British only, it's for British eyes only. Essentially, what happens during the Second World War is that the Anglophone powers really collaborate closely in SIGINT. And essentially, they're sharing everything technically. They're cooperating extremely closely in command terms. And when the war is over, the British and the Americans both conclude that it makes sense to continue that cooperation. If you don't cooperate, that means you're going to have to treat the other as a rival and you'll lose its help. If you do cooperate, you're multiplying your strengths against an emerging problem, the Russians. And so for that reason, the British and Americans agree that they will allow their SIGINT agencies to maintain a subnational arrangement that is not a treaty, but which does enable the British, Americans, and Canadians, for example, to coordinate their SIGINT every day, share most of their product, share their technical experiences, divide tasks. So if you're working against the Soviets, the British, Americans, and Canadians all divide quite rationally the targets they can go after. They share the take, they share the product. And in many cases, it's impossible to tell in a given arrangement where the American effort stops and the British one begins. Now, what that means is that American and British SIGINTers share more with each other than they do with their own national organizations. NSA gives GCHQ more access to what it does than NSA would give to the CIA or to the American military. So it is an unusual organization.
Yeah, and also maybe it explains a term we often hear, especially during the Brexit debate and when we talk about trade deals, we talk about the special relationship between Britain and the United States. And of course, often that is we point to the Second World War as the origins of that relationship. But how important do you think GCHQ has been to maintain the Anglo-America, especially during the Cold War? And also, has it changed now?
I would say that GCHQ and NSA were the core of a special relationship. That is where the wartime relationship never ends. And it continues all the way through the Cold War. The British and the Americans are both free to say to the other, we're going to share almost everything, but there is one area we won't share in. And so, for example, during the Ulster Troubles, the British didn't provide the Americans with whatever SIGINT they collected. And the Americans don't pass over what they get from Israel necessarily to the British. So there are exceptions to the cooperation, but it's basically very close. And what it meant throughout the Cold War is that, in effect, GCHQ could affect American policy from within Washington. GCHQ, in fact, was known to be a trustworthy and competent and loyal ally. It worked directly in D.C. And the British could receive and comment on American intelligence material.
Yeah.
All the way through the Cold War, there is an unprecedentedly close Anglo-American relationship and intelligence assessment that goes all the way to the end of the Cold War. Now, since the Cold War, the relationship has changed. And oddly enough, I'd say the GCHQ became relatively more powerful.
Mm-hmm.
It freed up its resources from monitoring individual Russian radio nets. It could focus on looking for new targets. And the end result is that it actually, and it also was on the internet, probably 5 to 8 years ahead of the Americans. And so the end result is that the British actually became explorers of this new world, and they could share what they knew with the Americans. So up until the present day, the Five Eyes remain very close, even though Britain has declined significantly as a military power since 1992.
But would you say that GCHQ is a more effective organization than NSA, which is the National Security Agency, by the way?
I would say that they're two very different organizations which share common targets.
Mm-hmm.
And because they do things differently and have different strengths and weaknesses, that means that each of them actually can provide something unique to coverage and analysis.
Mm.
And British and American SIGINTERs constantly say to me, two eyes are better than one, two heads are better than one.
Yeah.
And what you would find is that the British like to think of themselves as being better at individual creative work than Americans are. And I have to say, I've seen some reason to believe that's true. On the other hand, NSA has been one of the greatest disruptive technological forces in modern history, and it's really driven the development of SIGINT. And so the two of them actually together are an extremely formidable group. The Canadians, British, and the New Zealanders are useful but less significant.
Mm-hmm.
But collectively, they are far and away the strongest signals intelligence alliance, quote, end quote, in the world or in history.
We've almost started to touch on this, but tell me about what you call SIGINT's second phase, and that is from 1990 onwards. What defines this period?
The key thing is that what I do is say that there are two ages of SIGINT. One starts in 1914, the other, let's say, 1995. The first age is characterized by states attacking states. They're working primarily on radio, mostly high frequency, but also cables or communication satellites. The second age of SIGINT, which really begins in the mid-90s, moves at a time when everyone is relying on modes of internet communication, which are primarily telephone, but also fiber optic satellite communications, where suddenly it's impossible to segregate military traffic from civilian traffic. So in the old days, GCHQ would know that it was not allowed to touch a telephone communication within Britain. It was illegal. On the other hand, if you intercepted any telephone communication in the ether, you were free to do it. Nowadays, the way the internet works means that our communications could be being routed through Beijing.
Mm.
And it also means that if Russian intelligence in Petersburg is communicating with Russian intelligence in Moscow, that might pass through London. You can't tell when you've intercepted a communication what its national origin is. It's only when you touch it to find out that you can determine that. Now, the final thing is that back in before 1992, foreign entities found it really hard to acquire communications from within another country. So if you were a Canadian, you could send a letter, mail, snail mail. You could communicate by landline. You could send a telegraph, and the odds of any foreign government intercepting it were very, very low. Nowadays, all of our communications as private individuals, and even worse, all of our files, the equivalent of the letters we used to keep in filing cabinets, are all online.
Yeah.
So suddenly, all of us as individuals are exposed to SIGINT by other people, and the same thing is true for people on the other side. beyond that, only states used to be able to have SIGINT agencies.
Yeah.
Nowadays, there are millions of entities that have some primitive SIGINT capabilities. And some of them, some private entities, have great SIGINT capabilities. So for us as individuals, suddenly we are potential targets to cyber criminals in other countries. And even worse for those of us from Western countries, our governments are collecting our communications as part of bulk collection. Mm. And the key thing is that we need to make sure that they don't ever actually read our communications once they know that it's from you and me, which I believe actually has been done within the Five Eyes and probably in countries like Sweden.
Yeah.
Although I have to say, I have my suspicions about France, shall we say. But the end result is that potentially SIGINT agencies are much more intrusive than before and have to be monitored to ensure that they don't overstep their bounds. And it also means that all of us are vulnerable to other countries.
Something that comes to mind is first you try to sort of, this is like an arms race between privacy and then people sort of trying to tap in, and you use crypto, you use different ways of protecting your information. But does it in the end lead to that we go from high tech to low tech in order to protect what is really valuable? That the things that are not for anyone else's eyes will not ever be online, and that you will use other forms of communications again, or sort of old school forms of communication in order to safeguard your secrets?
Yes, if I were to try to communicate something secretly, I would either use snail mail or I would work out a prearranged verbal agreement with somebody that we were going to phone each other out of the blue at a given specific time. And if you did that, it's not easy for anybody else to pick you up. For what it's worth, professional SIGINTers actually will travel thousands of miles in order to have a meeting face-to-face rather than rely on any form of communications.
Yeah.
But we're told, for example, that the SVB and other Russian intelligence agencies bought up lots and lots of electric typewriters several years ago in order to have purely paper communications that couldn't be intercepted by other people. So yes, what you're saying is correct.
Let's talk a bit about the institutional culture of GCHQ. First of all, go back a bit. You showed that Palmerston wasn't too impressed by the first code breakers. How did that evolve as a sort of a set of practices?
Well, most European countries and from the 1400s onward, but certainly the 1600s, maintain some kind of code-breaking capability. And that ends in the middle 19th century because the nature of codes, the nature of how you transmit them change. And there's a break. There's a period when only a handful of states conduct code-breaking. But from the 1890s onward, it becomes a larger group of people. And from the First World War onward, everybody does it. So there's a period of revolutionary change in the way code breaking works. Mm-hmm. In the old days, code breaking focused essentially on diplomatic communications. That's to say, up until the mid 19th century. It was military and diplomatic from 1914 onward. And now it's still primarily military and diplomatic, but there is a focus much more on economic intelligence gathering. And also terrorism.
Mm-hmm. You also talk about the unusual role of women in the organization. Was GCHQ more meritocratic than other Whitehall departments, you think?
Yes, but you have to be willing to accept that there are lots of changes in the way it operates. In the First World War, because able-bodied men were needed on the front, when Britain creates these SIGINT agencies out of the blue, there is a very striking proportion of women. Most of them are data processors, but some of them are code breakers. Mm. And the same thing happens for the British all the way through to the end of the Second World War. GCNCS is much more open to women than any other British agency. After the Second World War, women have a higher status than they do in, say, the Foreign Office or MI5 or MI6. But it's a lower status than it had been before, and they're still actually not as progressive as one might think. In the United States, on the other hand, from early 1950 onward, women received a far greater chance to rise than they did in any other security agency in the Western world. Hmm. And from around 1979 onward, women routinely were at the top of NSA. So what I'd say is that you're looking at agencies which are progressive historically for institutional reasons. In other words, women have lots of brains, and if they're smarter than men and they can prove it, well, secret agencies are willing to give them a break.
Yeah, and MI9 is another organization which we did a podcast earlier on MI9 with Helen Fry, and she pointed out that intelligence agencies also see it's they're so dependent on smart people, so they just take the best ones, and in that sense they become meritocratic just by the work they do.
They can be, and the thing about SIGINT is it's such a strange trade. There's so many different unusual things you need that you will take on anyone who has those abilities, especially when you're expanding.
Yeah.
So in the Second World War, women are brought in large numbers to do lots of important creative things, as well as doing the really boring work of monitoring the machines that you use to crack Enigma, because you need them and because men are being used on the front and therefore aren't available to do other things.
So GCHQ has, of course, tried to avoid the public eye as much as possible. And its operations are obviously done under strict confidentiality. Can we get a sense of how GCHQ has managed its public reputations over the years?
GCHQ tried to manage it up until 1970 by maintaining absolute secrecy. Mm-hmm. It tried to prevent any discussions about SIGINT or about itself. And so when David Kahn, the pioneering SIGINT historian, wrote The Codebreakers in 1966, the GCHQ and NSA were horrified, and they regarded this as a first-class threat to national security. From 1970 onward, when it became clear that the story of Ultra was going to be known, because French and Polish participants were already writing about it, then GCHQ, with reluctance, was driven to try to manage its entry into the public sphere, and it didn't handle it very well. There were lots of scandals, its attempts to prevent unofficial people from writing about its work led to embarrassing court cases. But the main difference really comes, I'd say, around 2013-14, when the Snowden disclosures are leaked. And in the end, I have to say, as a professional, I'm not convinced that Snowden's leaks demonstrated that the Five Eyes had done anything illegal or wrong.
No.
And I'm actually one of those who believe that the only people who gained from Snowden were the Russians, the Chinese, and cyber criminals.
Yeah.
But the fact of the matter is that what Snowden did was release enough material that the question of what SIGINT did became a major public issue. GCHQ realized how vulnerable it was to looking bad. It was fortunate that, in fact, it had been absolutely clear with governments and with parliamentary oversight committees as to what it was doing.
Yeah.
And British politicians defended GCHQ as having acted appropriately and legally. But at that moment, GCHQ said, we're going to have to become more open. And the decision they made was to start to open their work to the public more than before. This was also important because of the fact that the second age of SIGINT meant that GCHQ actually had to provide public warning and advice to British firms and British people about threats to cybersecurity. And in fact, at the present day, the head of GCHQ and the head of the National Cybersecurity Center, which is the partly secret, partly open organization which advises British people on cybersecurity, both speak openly and frequently to the press.
Yeah.
So in operational terms, being open became unavoidable. And so GCHQ, with a lot of internal reluctance, decided that we're going to have to become translucent.
Mm.
And by that, I don't mean transparent, because transparency is impossible for a secret agency. But you at least had to make it clear what you were doing and why. And my history was commissioned in that context, in the sense that GCHQ said, well, if we're going to do this, we need to make it possible for people to see what we've done.
Yeah.
And so what I'd say is that GCHQ has crossed the Rubicon. There's no going back now. And indeed, you cannot function as a secret agency with the high level of secrecy that they once pursued. And what has been happening in the past few days with the Russian penetrations of American communication systems goes to show part of the reason.
Yeah.
You know, if you're dealing with this kind of threat, you need your people to understand what it is, and they need to know who is protecting them and giving them advice.
So now, looking to 2021 and beyond, what are the new technological trends GCHQ must master?
I think that they've mastered the essential ones that are going to be driving things for the next 20 years. I mean, essentially, the major change came with PCs and with the rise of the internet, and that's 30 years ago. That transformed fundamentally the basic nature of the game. And it also transformed the way encryption works and the way attacks on communications are going to have to work. The main things that GCHQ is doing now that I think are good and necessary are to recognize that you need a more diverse workforce than in the past, that you're going to have to draw upon people who've been underrepresented in the organization in the past, so ethnic minorities, women, people who are autistic, people who have different ways of looking at things. And you also have to be able to draw upon the leading British people you can find who work in communications, data processing, and you need also to maintain your very high level of skill in cryptanalysis. And if there's any area where the British have maintained surprising power, it is in the skills of the people who do the most secret and important part of the work, which is breaking encryption. The British have had a good track record of success there, but they have to ensure that they don't overlook sources of these very scarce skills. But I would say that generally, I think the GCHQ is on the right track. It is actually in the midst of transforming itself. It's expanding in numbers, but it's also making sure that it's able to attract people from different groups than it's done before. And it is trying to find ways to encourage young people, especially girls, to consider SIGINT as a career and to understand exactly what is involved in SIGINT.
John Ferries, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
History Lessons is a podcast from the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation.